Hey, lifelong learner, Humanities North Dakota is offering an online class on prophetic leadership. This class will center around conversations about prophetic leadership and its relevance for the contemporary world. Information and registration can be found at humanitiesnd.org. Your first class is complimentary with registration.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we check in on vaccination rates across the state. But we are going to start today with a conversation about critical race theory. Joining me is Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a UND Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Jack, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, Ashley, especially for something like this where 18 months ago, no one ever heard of it and now everyone's an expert.
Well, yeah, that's basically my first question here is because this theory came to be about 40 years ago, and now all of the sudden it is in all the headlines. It was mentioned 132 times on Fox News in 2020 alone. Before we even get into why are we talking about this as a problem after 40 years, what is this?
So critical race theory is really interesting, and I do basically a two-day unit on it in my philosophy of law class because it is first and foremost a legal theory. And it's a way of looking at our institutions to see how race works and doesn't work in our law and in our government structure. But it can be made wider and broader to look at most institutions through that. But let me explain what that means. A 30-second lesson on literary theory, right? So if you were going to be an English major, everything you need to know in the next 30 seconds. All literary theory is taking an idea and analyzing a book or a story or something like that through that idea. So I want to read this book from the perspective of women. I want to read this book from the perspective of chairs. I want to read this book from the perspective of the poor. I want to read this book from the perspective of aliens from outer space. And very simplistically, what English majors do is look at literature from all those perspectives and compare the experience of reading or talking about or analyzing from that. Critical race theory is something like that. It's an approach to analyze the government from the perspective of race as opposed to how do the laws work if you're from a rural community or how do the laws work if you're from an immigrant family or how do the laws work if you are illiterate, right? One of the things we can know about street signs is that street signs are designed not just for people who can read but for people who can't read. Mm-hmm. And that's why each street sign has a different kind of shape. Critical race theory is that. It's a filter we put on things in order to analyze our laws, our government from a certain perspective.
So why has it become problematic in the last year and a half?
Well, there's the practical reason and then there's the theoretical reason. The practical reason is, and I've forgotten his name, so I apologize, but there is a behind-the-scenes guy who gives conservative Republicans talking points, and he decided to focus on this and gave them money, and it filtered through the conservative first blogosphere and then the internet and then Fox News, and it just became something to talk about. And one of the theories as to why people are talking about it is that when you're talking about critical race theory, you're not talking about universal health care. When you're talking about critical race theory, you're not talking about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. When you're not talking about critical race theory, you're not talking about whatever. One of my favorite factoids, and I think this is true because no one ever said or said I was wrong about this, but one of my favorite factoids is that more legislation was passed during the Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton impeachment hearings than in any other time in history because everyone was so distracted by the circus of the impeachment that they weren't paying attention to what the legislature was doing, and the legislature could get away with doing things that they wouldn't necessarily do when everyone was focusing on it. And so most of the debate about critical race theory is political theater to distract people from other things.
How do you, as a philosopher, actually go about teaching this in class? And is it fair to say you're teaching it? Because I had a conversation last week with the president of North Dakota United, Nick Archuleta, and he said it's not really something that teachers or professors are teaching. This is the way that a system worked. It's more so an invitation to debate.
Well, so this is one of the things that non-teachers don't understand, especially in the upper levels of high school and college. You have to distinguish between teaching information and teaching skills. Mm-hmm. So when I teach things in my philosophy class, I certainly teach critical race theory, but I don't teach critical race theory as this is the way you should look at the world. I teach critical race theory as here are a bunch of thinkers. Here are some assumptions they make. Here are some claims they make. Let's talk about how they're good. Let's talk about how they're bad. Let's talk about what they bring to the table. So let me give you a piece of that. One of the fundamental assumptions of critical race theory is that race is a construction. What does that mean? It means that there's no such objective thing as race, being white, being black. Where we go from that, I'm not sure, right? Being Asian, being Native American, are these races or are these not races? The idea of a race has been invented first by biologists and then by politicians and anthropologists to describe clusters of people. But let's say you have two parents, a purely white parent, whatever that means, and a purely black parent, whatever that means, and they have a kid. Is the kid black or is the kid white? You can't answer that question because race is a fiction. Race is a construction. Race is something we use to describe other things. They, for a while, had a term which is no longer in common use called mulatto, but all mulatto was you know, half black, half white. In the history of the United States, we followed what has often been called the one drop rule, which is if a person has had one drop of black blood, which of course is a nonsensical statement in itself, but if you had one drop of black blood, then they were black. You saw that something similar in the Nuremberg laws under Hitler, where according to the Germans, if you had one grandparent who was Jewish, you were considered Jewish. All of these things are ways of making sense of a subjective idea, and that subjective idea is race. And so critical race theory first just starts off by saying this idea of race isn't natural. It's not scientific. It's not objective. It's a tool we use. It's a construction we use in order to talk about how we cluster people in society in terms of for anthropological reasons, for political reasons, for economic reasons. And so the question then is, do you object to your teacher asking the student, hey, do you think race is real or do you think race is a construction? If you don't object to that, you don't object to teaching critical race theory.
How are the students reacting?
The students love it. I mean, we're at a generational shift because most of the students are very comfortable with the idea of race as a social construction. Many of them think that gender is a social construction and sex is a social construction. A lot of the ideas that were super controversial and sort of hard to grasp when I was in college are now just sort of par for the course. I used to teach a unit on the ethics of gay marriage, having students debate whether or not gay marriage is moral or not. And I don't do it anymore because students don't care. They just are like, yeah, gay people get married. Big deal. You know, there's always going to be one or two students who object for religious reasons, but I couldn't have it as my final discussion anymore because it just wasn't controversial. It's the same sort of thing. Students don't have a problem with the idea that race is a theory, sorry, is a construction. They just may not have the words for it and they may not have the venue to sort of work out the details.
Hmm. Do you ever hear from parents? I know it's a little different because at this point the kids are in college.
I never hear from parents. My students know better. And one of the reasons why my students know better is that as a college student, college students are protected under what's called FERPA, the Federal Education Records Protection Act, which means once they're over 18, parents can't even look at their records or have conversations with us without written permission from the students because they're adults. I've never had a conversation with my daughter's friends' parents or about these sorts of complaints. What parents are upset about is when the classroom is all worksheets or when the teacher is overworked and underpaid and has to pay for the pencils for themselves, right? Parents are concerned with access to teachers. They're concerned with funding. They're concerned with options for electives, whether or not there's going to be art class or music class or computer graphics class or something like that. They're much less concerned about critical race theory. And I guarantee you that if you ask 95% of the people who are even writing editorials about critical race theory, they don't know what critical race theory is. They think it's something else.
We're visiting with Jack Russell Weinstein, a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota. We are talking about critical race theory. And many of the opponents of critical race theory, they're saying, for example, let's look at the United States. And in the 400 years since the Mayflower landed, this has become an incredibly wealthy nation. We have some of the best trauma medical care in the world. There have been a number of scientific advances going back to the space race. You know, we're the ones that get to the moon. We have done a lot in this country. And, for example, Senator Ted Cruz has said critical race theory says that every white person is a racist. What is your reaction as a political philosopher to the statement that if we go back and criticize the methods that gave rise to a world superpower, what's your reaction to that?
Well, Ted Cruz doesn't know what he's talking about. And Ted Cruz is saying something that, you know, is not remotely defensible or true. Now, there may be individual critical race theorists who have said things like that. I don't know all of them and I haven't read everything. But that's nonsense. Here's what critical race theory says. Critical race theory says that we have to look at the institutions of society to see how the laws and the government create structures that make it harder for, in particular, African Americans to succeed than others. Now, this word institution is ambiguous because we think of, like, you know, the Bank of America as an institution, but marriage is also an institution, right? And anyone knows that there are plenty parts of the country where if you have a black person and a white person who are married and walking together down the street, they get funny looks, right? That's critical race theory is going to talk about that. But what strikes me about the resistance critical race theory is that I actually think that North Dakotans would benefit and would like the critical race theorist filter of this state. Why? Because we all know that there are very, very few African Americans in North Dakota. If there's no critical race theory, if it's just personal prejudice, then the answer to the question, why are there no black people in North Dakota, is North Dakotans are a bunch of racists, right? They're a bunch of white people who hate black people and they're going to burn people's houses down. Now, that's not true. It shouldn't be said and no one should believe it. What critical race theory says is, look, there are strong institutions about how migration works in the United States, how the history of moving from the rural South to the urban North works, how labor works, that push African Americans away from rural communities and rural states and push them away from the plain states to the urban centers. So it's not the North Dakotans' fault for not having any African Americans in their community because many of them are super welcoming and would love to have diverse neighbors. Without critical race theory, the only reason why North Dakota doesn't have a diverse population is that North Dakotans don't want it. And critical race theory is a way of liberating the North Dakotan population from that guilt by saying, look, there are these complex forces that if we understand, we'll not only understand why there are no African Americans here or very few, but also what we could do to be more welcoming institutionally and structurally.
Is there anything to be said for looking at critical race theory in terms of, hey, this is the progress that we've made? We no longer use phrenology, for example, the size of a person's skull, and an incredibly racist science that said, you know, because we have bigger skulls, we have better brains. Could we just look at it as, hey, we don't do that anymore?
Right. So there are two parts to this. The first is that example you use is a wonderful example because Stephen Jay Gould, the scientist, went and looked at that data and saw that, you know, the scientists thought that skull size was intelligent, and they took skulls from white people and filled it up with ball bearings. And they took skulls from black people and filled them up with ball bearings. And they counted the number of ball bearings, and they saw that white people had more ball bearings. But when Gould went back to the data, he actually saw that they actually had the same amount of ball bearings, but what the scientists were doing were rounding up for white people and rounding down for black people. So it always looked like they were more for white people and fewer for black people. And I don't think the scientists knew they were doing it. I don't think the scientists were consciously doing it. That was unconscious bias, right? And so it's not just that there has been progress from pseudoscience to science. It's that even the way that the scientists did science was swimming in this kind of racism that we wouldn't see, that we wouldn't acknowledge if we didn't look at the structures in the institutions. Now, I've seen on the internet a lot of people, and this is from the left, a lot of people saying if we don't teach critical race theory, we don't get to teach about the civil rights, and we don't get to teach. And that's not critical race theory either. That's just American history. You don't need critical race theory to teach the progress of equality. One of my all-time favorite quotes is from Chris Rock, the comedian, who says, "We always talk about how black people have progressed and how much better black people are doing, but in fact, it's white people who have progressed and white people are doing better because they are no longer as racist as they once were." Right? These are filters of understanding that we can use to understand why history unfolds, but the fact that there wasn't civil rights and there was civil rights isn't a matter of critical race theory at all. It's just the history of the United States.
Let's look at something that happened to me and tell me if I'm right or wrong here in trying to approach this through critical race theory. So this was a few years ago. I was pulled over. I had expired tabs on my plate and I didn't know. I mostly walk and I bike and I pay zero attention to my car. That's why I have a husband. I said it. But I had expired tabs. And this was just a couple of weeks after Philando Castile was pulled over and he ended up, as we know, dead in a very similar sort of interaction with the police. And I said, oh, I didn't even know my tabs were expired. My husband got something in the mail the other day. And it turns out it really was a mistake. They mailed the ones for his work truck and he put those on the car or whatever. It was just a mistake. But it was automatically assumed that I was telling the truth and that it was an absolute clerical error. And then I just got to go home on my merry way, which is how it can be and should be. If you didn't actually do anything wrong, it shouldn't be an issue. But then we go and we look at a case like Philando Castile and so many others where there was this similar, they didn't actually really do anything all that wrong, but ended up with much more dramatic circumstances. Do we look at something like that through the lens of critical race theory?
So again, I have a two-part answer. The first is the most powerful anecdote or little bit that comes from my reading critical race theory is the following. When you think about when the Civil Rights Act was passed, one day President Johnson signed the act into law and it was law. Allegedly, all the laws and the structure of racism changed in our society, but the people who interpreted the law on that Monday were the same people who interpreted the law that Friday. So all the people who had spent all of their time making decisions pre-Civil Rights Act are the exact same people who are making decisions post-Civil Rights Act. Is their rationality, is their way of thinking going to change automatically because the law is changed? No. Why? Because they have a history of doing things. I read this really, really interesting piece on the internet about a woman who moved from one area I think it was the Midwest, and she had never been stopped in her car and she had never been bothered, and she's a white woman, and then all of a sudden she's being stopped every day, and they would come at her with hands on their guns, and then they'd see her and they'd open the door and they'd look annoyed and then they'd walk away, and they'd say she was driving too slow, which, if you know, she was driving 2 miles below the limit. So one day she is having, you know, lunch, and someone comes up to her and says, and this is almost an exact quote from the Post, "There's a black man trying to steal your truck." And she looks, and she's got a massive black French poodle that she drives with curly black hair, who likes to sit in the front seat with her. And people see the poodle through the window and think that there's an African-American man in the shotgun seat. And so what the cops were doing were seeing this white woman with a black man in the seat, assuming something was wrong, and stopping her over and over and over and over again. And when she didn't have the poodle in the front seat, she was never stopped. And when she did have the poodle in the front seat, she was. Now, is that because every single police officer is racist? No, it's certainly not that simple. But the fact that they're walking to the car with their hands on their guns, which they probably didn't do for you when you were stopped, and one of the police officers is standing far away from the truck and the other is ordering them to open their windows, and then they're super tense, and then they see it's a dog, and then they relax. Critical race theory helps us understand and map out what's going on there, and saying the issue isn't Officer Smith or Jones. The issue is how the police are trained, how the laws are enforced, and what kind of acceptable cues allow a police officer to pull someone over. And here's just a minor thing, right? I went to school for 7 years to be 7 years of a PhD program to be a professor. Police officers who have a much more important job than I have and a much more dangerous job than I have will go to academy for anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months. There's no room for the subtle lessons. And so a lot of police officers learn most of what they need to know on the streets from other police officers, right? There's that movie Training Day, which is famously about this, and other movies like that. If police officers had 3 years or 4 years of training, and training in de-escalation tactics, and training in being aware of not just their own biases, because that's a loaded phrase, but being aware of the patterns that we rely on when we see and do certain things, then they would react better in a lot of these situations. So along comes someone who says, from a critical race theory perspective, police academy is too short, and because it's too short, it's racist. What people who don't understand critical race theory will hear is, all police officers are racist. But what the critical race theorists people are saying is, look, this stuff is hard, it's subtle, and there's hundreds and hundreds of years of history. So we're going to need more than 6 months to help people overcome the bad lessons they've learned from growing up in this country. We want to underscore the good lessons. We want to underscore all the wonderful things that they've learned. But we also have to negate the negative things, especially when you're a police officer. Critical race theory allows us to say, maybe in the name of equality, police academy should be 3 years long, 4 years long, instead of 6 weeks or 6 months, but depending on whether it's a local or a state trooper.
Jack Russell Weinstein is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota and the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. We have him on once a month for a philosopher's point of view on a major news story. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Still to come on Main Street, we learn about the state's efforts to promote vaccinations for COVID. But now, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state of North Dakota ended the 2019-2021 biennium with more than $1 billion in the bank. That's $300 million more than the legislature expected. But a lot of that money is already spoken for in the upcoming budget period. Here's State Budget Director Joe Morissette.
The legislative budget assumed that we would have an ending balance of $710 million. So basically, $700 million was already built into the next budget for expenditure. So, you know, we're talking about an increase of somewhere around $300 million, a little bit more than $300 million, which is, of course, you know, significant, a huge amount of money. But when we talk about the billion, it is important to note that 70% or so of that was anticipated and was built into the next biennium spending plan.
Morissette says the books on the 2019-2021 biennium won't be closed until Friday, so that ending fund balance may still go up a little bit. The federal deadline for getting a real ID is now May 3, 2023, and the North Dakota Department of Transportation says its driver's license division is still seeing a strong demand for real ID.
We're running about 60 to 70% of people that are coming in to get a credential are leaving with a real ID.
Brad Schaefer is the driver's license director.
Currently, right now, we're at 45% of our licensed drivers and ID card holders in the state that are real ID compliant. So, you know, we're getting there now. We got a little extra time. So we still encourage everyone to get their real ID when they come in.
Schaefer says you should make an appointment to come in and receive your real ID. He says driver's license sites across the state normally have same-day appointments available. And North Dakota Aeronautics Commission Director Kyle Warner says he would love to see the Canadian border opened up again because some Canadians would fly out of North Dakota's airports to U.S. and other destinations.
You know, when you go back to 2012, 2013 time frame, when you looked at Grand Forks, Minot, and even Williston, those three airports that are kind of up by our northern border, we actually saw quite a bit of Canadian traffic that came down to the states.
Warner says the downturn in the oil industry affected that, and then COVID-19 hit, and the border was essentially closed.
You know, it would be nice to get back to a period where we can once again attract Canadian travelers to actually come down and shop in our state, and also fly out to United States destinations. You know, there are some larger populous areas just north of the border, you know, specifically Winnipeg, that, you know, are places that in the past we have been able to draw some passengers from.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck. A Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
Some people thrive in high-pressure situations, and some don't.
Choking occurs when you feel the most pressure, you want to put your best foot forward, you know how to do it, and then all of a sudden, you just can't pull it off.
How to fight anxiety when it matters most, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is out on medical leave. And we are going to talk now about vaccination rates for the COVID-19 pandemic and how our state compares with the nation and some funding that has recently surfaced in an effort to increase vaccination rates. Joining me now is Dr. Paul Carson. He is the medical director of the NDSU Center for Immunization Research and Education. Dr. Carson, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Also in studio is Kylie Hall. She is the operations manager, and she holds a master's degree in public health. Kylie, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with the vaccination rates across the state of North Dakota. As I understand it, it's 39.9% is the average, but then, of course, that breaks down, you know, sometimes different age groups. So in your opinion, as a medical director, Dr. Carson, what is the age group that you think is doing or that is doing the best for vaccination?
Oh, certainly the age group that's doing the best is the 75 and older.
Okay.
You know, I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but they were well over 75-80% had taken one or more doses of the vaccine. Of course, we have children under the age of 12 that aren't eligible, but mm-hmm. then kind of getting going up from there, it's the, you know, adolescents that are sort of running the lowest, and then that sort of 20 to 25 year old age group is still the least vaccinated.
Okay. Those are also the age groups that have the worst health outcomes, that 75 plus if they don't get immunized, and the best health outcomes if they don't get immunized, that younger group. Does that mean that you don't really need to be concerned about the big disparity between those two groups?
Absolutely not. So, I mean, we could walk through some of the different issues for the age groups, but I think one of the important things for people to realize is as the Delta variant is increasing around the world, and it's now becoming very rapidly, is already the dominant strain in the United States and probably already here in North Dakota. that is shifting to seem to infect more readily younger populations. It's not completely clear yet, but there's some evidence that it actually may be more virulent, meaning that it causes worse sickness, greater chance of hospitalization, greater chance of death. Now, still in the very young and the healthy, that tends to be rare, but it far exceeds what we see, for example, with influenza. And those have been targeted groups for influenza vaccination for a long time. On a very conservative side of things, children account for up to somewhere around 15 to 20,000 hospitalizations last year and a little over 300 deaths. And these are preventable. And I think more importantly is that what we're seeing with long COVID, the protracted outcomes, seem to affect both the young and the old. This is something that's of great concern to us in the healthcare profession. There are now specialty centers and clinics opening up in large medical centers around the country to deal with the complications of long COVID. And those do not spare the young. In fact, in one large study of outpatients, so that tends to be milder illness, even in that 18 to 49-year-old age group, out to 6 months, over a quarter were reporting one or more symptoms. That's in mild illness, 6 months out. It goes much higher as you get older. And so these are real problems that are completely preventable.
Kylie, would you say at this point, is it more a matter of access or attitude about vaccines when we talk about the rate of vaccination across the state?
While I think that access certainly still plays a part in the reason that some people aren't vaccinated, I think attitudes and beliefs and knowledge regarding COVID vaccine are the drivers of non-vaccination for the majority of North Dakotans, either not understanding why they need to be vaccinated, not understanding how it benefits them, or just why vaccination is important. I think those are probably more drivers at this point than access, but there definitely are still barriers to vaccination out there. And those are some of the things that we're hoping that we can work towards, removing barriers for people and increasing knowledge and attitudes about vaccination in some of our projects in our center.
And those projects, $5.7 million over the course of 3 years for, I guess it's fair to say your main goal is to increase vaccination rates, right?
Absolutely.
That's the end goal?
Absolutely. So we have $5.7 million that we received from the North Dakota Department of Health by way of the CDC. And those dollars will be used in our center to hire a number of project managers and to work with some of the different faculty and staff at North Dakota State to try and increase vaccination rates in a number of ways. So we are going to be working to educate providers around the state so that they feel confident in their knowledge about COVID, COVID vaccine, and how to recommend the vaccine at the medical encounter. But we're also going to be using different strategies such as, you know, using pharmacists as immunizers. If you look around the state of North Dakota and a lot of rural America, we have a shortage of primary care providers. But in North Dakota, we're really lucky. We have an abundance of pharmacists, and a lot of them are in our rural communities. So how can we use pharmacists not only to give immunizations, but to boost confidence in immunizations as well? That's one of the things we hope to accomplish. We'll be working with our American Indian Public Health Resource Center. We have a vaccine communications project that's coming out of this, doing a lot of vaccine education around the state. Those are all some of the things that we hope to accomplish in the next 3 years.
I was on the Johns Hopkins website, and the mortality rate for COVID in the United States is 1.8%. That is a very low number of people who are dying as a result of the coronavirus. How necessary is it to get a vaccine against something that has such a low mortality rate?
So I would first say that is not a low mortality rate. So when you look at what I do for a living, you know, prior to teaching at NDSU, which is my specialty, I'm a physician specializing in infectious diseases. If we looked at all infections and saw a 1.8%, let every person with that infection, 1.8% of them would die, that's actually quite high. That's many, many fold higher than, for example, influenza.
Okay.
But take it another step and go beyond just mortality. And actually, before I leave mortality, it's very different depending on how old you are. So you're going to get up closer to 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10% as you get older. But look at hospitalizations, for example. Hospitalization rates are closer to an average of all comers, around 5%, and that rapidly goes up by age group as well. Mm-hmm. And if you land in the hospital with COVID, your chances of having long-term problems after you come out are very, very high. So this is not an inconsequential virus. And a recent perspective piece in the New England Journal of Medicine said nation's next sort of impending health crisis is going to be the deluge of what we're dealing with long COVID, the long-term complications and sequelae of a COVID infection.
Is it sufficient to just vaccinate the people who are in those higher risk categories?
No, I don't think that's a good approach. Certainly, we would want to emphasize to the people in the higher risk categories, please get to the front of the line. And if you haven't had your vaccine yet, get it now as soon as possible. But even in the healthy 20-year-old age group, when you look at what I've just talked about, these consequences of risk of hospitalization, long COVID, that's there. These are real problems that people contend with for a long time. And the risk of death is not zero. These are preventable deaths. Any of these are preventable deaths. So although we may want to emphasize people at higher risk to be a priority for vaccination, we think this is clearly something necessary for probably all age groups. I think the data still needs to come in on children. We need to see those clinical trials play out. But and we're not going to get to any semblance of herd immunity without most of us participating.
And that herd immunity is about 70%?
We thought that with the prior variants, with the Delta variant, which appears to be much more contagious, probably about twice as contagious as the original strain, about 50-60% more contagious than the Alpha variant, that's probably pushing now 80+%, unfortunately.
I think when you talk about just vaccinating the vulnerable, it reminds me of what we were talking about earlier when you said, do we need to be vaccinating, children and talking about that. I think it's important for people to understand that anybody could be that link in the chain of transmission. Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to stop infection where it's happening, and that might be vaccinating a young adult. That might be vaccinating an older person. While the young people may be infected and they may be just fine, they may be sick for a few days, maybe have no symptoms, they could spread it to somebody who spreads it to somebody who gives it to grandma or who gives it to that healthcare worker or who mm-hmm. isn't fine after their infection. And that's why it's important to vaccinate everyone who's eligible. Everybody can be that link in the chain.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think that falls under that category of when we were talking about is it access or attitude, that falls under that attitude category. And you look at societies that really stress community, and then you look at societies that really stress rugged individualism, and the U.S. has a long history of championing the rugged individualism. What's your approach for messaging just about that link in the chain?
I'll take one stab at that. Mm-hmm. So although I think we have some of that sense of rugged individualism amongst North Dakotans, I grew up in Western North Dakota. I grew up around ranchers and, out in the country. And there's that sense of sort of can-do, taking care of myself and so on. But we also have a deep ethic of taking care of one another. I mean, you would see when – I've seen this recently with some family friends where – somebody gets sick or dies in the neighboring farm and everybody comes around to put in their crop or to harvest their crop or to help with the cattle. Probably the proudest I've ever been of my community that I live in was when we had the floods, back in the 90s in Fargo, and just seeing everybody coming together to help each other out, even when their property wasn't threatened. So I think we do have that sense of helping each other out and taking care of one another. I think the difficulty has been people seeing that direct connection of themselves being the person that might put others at risk. And getting back to your early question, should we just leave it to the people who are vulnerable? Let me point out that 47% of the population has one or more conditions that put them at higher risk for a bad outcome from COVID. The number one risk is age. We have a lot of people over the age of 65 in North Dakota, and we care about them, right? We care about grandmas and grandpas. We care about our aunts and uncles and so on. But one of the next biggest categories is obesity. Unfortunately, we have a lot of people who are overweight and obese. It's over 30% of the population, adult population. Hypertension, diabetes. When you combine all of those, it is 47% of the population has one or more risk factors for a bad outcome from COVID. Mm-hmm. This is like a lot of those people are in our families, right, and are us.
And a lot of people who have died from COVID are young, healthy people. It's not the majority, but at this point in time, those deaths are preventable. It's, you know, a brother, sister, cousin, mom, dad. These deaths are preventable with the COVID vaccine.
One thing, and I want to keep this focus on the vaccine, but this thread that you just mentioned, Dr. Carson, of the underlying conditions that are things like obesity, we are very good at responding to acute issues kind of after the fact.
Right.
And we have incredible trauma care in particular in Western medicine. But I wonder about this because we've been throwing around the word preventable disease a lot. And so much of this can come down to a lifestyle choice or what some people call a behavior-based disease. Are we at risk of over-concentrating on acute healthcare problems and not ever looking at the kinds of things that could prevent the chronic underlying conditions that a lot of U.S. people do have?
So you raised several good points. Let me unpack that a little bit. I had somebody correspond with me on why should we prevent this when – take your latest bit of drug misinformation out there. Ivermectin will cure this or hydroxychloroquine will cure this, even if we had a good treatment. Why we would try and play catch-up and hope that a treatment would fix something when you have something that can prevent it from ever happening in the first place is really beyond me. You know, the greatest accomplishments in public health has a list of, you know, there was a report at the end of the last century on what are the greatest accomplishments. Vaccine is in the, you know, amongst the top of the list. It has prevented far more deaths and chronic illness than almost anything we could do other than maybe clean water. That's sort of way up there. Unpacking another piece of it, which I think you're kind of getting at, what do we do to kind of prevent being at risk? Yeah, we need to be working much harder on preventing diabetes in the first place, managing our obesity epidemic, managing the things that come along with that, hypertension and so on. But we can't do that right now in the middle of a pandemic. We can't fix those things right now in the midst of a raging pandemic. We have to work on all of these things together, improving our underlying health so that we're less at risk, but also trying to manage a very contagious disease.
We're visiting today with Dr. Paul Carson. He is the medical director at the NDSU Center for Immunization Research and Education. And also we are visiting with operations manager there, Kylie Hall, who holds a master's degree in public health. And we're talking about a $5.7 million grant to be distributed over 3 years to help increase understanding and access to the COVID-19 vaccine. Kylie, I want to go back to the question of access. Are there certain pockets of the state that are still of higher concern for you?
In terms of access, I don't know that I'm particularly concerned about any area of the state. Early on, that was a goal of the North Dakota Department of Health when they were planning COVID vaccine distribution. One of their goals was to make sure they got it into nearly every community, absolutely every county. And I think they did a really good job of that. They distributed it not only to healthcare systems, but to clinics. They were giving it to local public health units and pharmacies. So it was out there and it was definitely accessible. Now, you know, speaking as, you know, July 2021, I know that there's still vaccine available around the state. I don't know exactly if there's any holes in access, but I think it's still readily accessible. And there are still a number of opportunities to get vaccinated. The health department is doing pop-up clinics throughout the state where they'll just show up at a Walmart. They're at the state fair this week giving COVID vaccines. So it's out there. And then local public health units and healthcare systems are giving it either in pop-up clinics or in their primary care settings. So I think access is there. But we need people to go in and get vaccinated, and that's where we need to move the needle.
What about as we come up, you know, right now it's summer. This is also a very easy state to social distance in. But as we come into the school year, as we come into the winter, you know, we've already gone through one winter of more people indoors. What are you concerned about and I don't want to keep saying head towards winter, but it is inevitable.
I think the thing that concerns me the most is knowing that the Delta variant is here and how contagious it is, and coupling that with people taking off their masks. If you go into public, I go to the grocery store, I go to, you know, my local big box stores, things like that, there are rarely people masked anymore. My husband's a teacher and he's going back to school in a month, and I don't know what the mask situation will be like. So I think, you know, the transmissibility of Delta coupled with just public mask use are some of the things that worry me.
Is NDSU's Center for Immunization Research and Education ever asked to weigh in on things like a school or a hospital mask mandate or policy?
Sure. We've been asked to weigh in on that a number of times. We were asked to provide education to some of the legislators when they were trying to decide on some of these issues. We try to stick to what's the science. What do we know? What do we not know? Where do we have gaps in science that needs to be filled? And so we try to maybe steer a little clear of overt policy statements and leave that to the Centers for Disease Control and to some of the professional societies. But we will do a lot to try and inform, like, what's the best science and best evidence we have out there right now for whatever that question may be.
Well, let's talk about that, because so much of the narrative during this pandemic has been, we don't exactly know how it spreads, and now we know how it spreads, and we don't know who's at risk, and now we know a little bit more who's at risk, and the immunizations, the vaccines are lifelong. Well, now you need a booster shot. I mean, at some point, do you understand the hesitancy behind Sure. people's reluctance to get Yeah. vaccines when this science, by virtue of the fact that it's a pandemic and it's Yeah. it's unfolding in unprecedented ways, and I understand that that science is hard to track, but that attitude of reluctance.
Sure. I understand that. And when the public gets to view sort of up close the scientific process playing out in real time, it's kind of like looking at sausage being made, and it's not pretty. So, you know, science never moves in sort of like, here's the study that just puts the nail in the coffin on the question. It moves upwards in a zigzag line. So you have, you know, studies that say maybe hydroxychloroquine is of benefit, and then another handful saying it isn't a benefit. And that's very confusing to people, but that's the way the scientific process works out. We say, let's get better and better evidence. Let's do a better study. Let's get more studies. And eventually you get closer and closer to the truth. And early on, you know, we didn't know anything about this virus. And so everybody got to watch real time. Are masks necessary or aren't they necessary? Is hydroxychloroquine beneficial or isn't it beneficial? They're getting to watch that in real time. And this is something we do in healthcare and medicine and science all the time, but it's very much on public display, and it feels like a whipsaw to people. But this is the scientific process. This is what's beautiful about the scientific process, is it does get you closer and closer to the truth. And if something doesn't sound right, somebody else will go study it and see if they can replicate your findings or not. And if they can't, calls it all into question. That's a good thing.
Dr. Paul Carson is the medical director at the NDSU Center for Immunization Research and Education. Thanks for your time today.
You're welcome.
And Kylie Hall is the operations manager at the Center for Immunization Research and Education. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck. Buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. We shift gears away from the well-established immigrant food traditions across the Midwest and into the impact second-wave immigrants have had on the region's culinary landscape. We are spotlighting Asian communities and their contribution to Midwestern foodways.
Eat Your Heartland Out, coming up Tuesday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 26th. On this date in 1907, the North Dakota School for the Deaf announced that the school had opened an exhibit at the Grand Forks Fair, where students displayed examples of work, including needlework, carpentry, and penmanship. The exhibit also featured photographs of the school. Before Dakota split into two states, deaf children in the territory could attend the Dakota Territorial School for the Deaf in Sioux Falls. However, few children were able to take advantage of the school because of the travel challenges. The Enabling Act, passed by Congress in 1889, required the new states of North and South Dakota to provide special education for physically handicapped children. South Dakota already had a school for the deaf. It was up to North Dakota to establish its own, and that came about in 1890 as directed by the state's constitution. The North Dakota School for the Deaf was designed as a residential facility. It provided elementary and secondary education. In order to be admitted to the school, children had to be so hearing impaired that they were unable to successfully get an education through the regular school system. North Dakota residents were entitled to a free education, and beginning in 2005, residents of other states could be admitted if they paid tuition. However, North Dakota residents took priority. When the school first opened, 4 students enrolled. By the end of the year, there were 23. The mission of the school required courses in communication and work skills. This was a profound change from previous attitudes when deaf people were often treated as outcasts and mentally deficient. The first vocation taught at the school was the printing trade, and the first issue of the school newspaper, the North Dakota Banner, was printed in 1891. In addition to providing educational services, the school continues to be an advocate for the hearing impaired. It provides outreach services, including the Parent-Infant Program, which offers resource materials for the parents of hearing impaired children. There's also an adult services program. The number of students has fluctuated, but the school's mission has grown as it has adapted to changing times. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Fire is an inevitable part of this landscape.
Across parts of the western U.S., a scorching heat wave, a deepening drought, and wildfires that won't stop burning. Some scientists say the cause is obvious.
I would say 95% of it's climate-driven.
What else might be influencing another bad fire season? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, when we think about the history of the Wild Wild West, we often think about cowboys. A new book tells the undertold story of the important work of women. It's called New Women in the Old West, From Settlers to Suffragists, An Untold American Story. And we are going to learn about how being from a rural state had some distinct advantages in terms of advancing women's rights. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.